In the summer of 1783, Collingwood was given command of Mediator, a 44-gun fourth-rate ship of the line, in effect a heavy frigate. But he had trouble finding enough men for her, a constant problem for the Navy. Mediator was bound for the West Indies, and she carried as passengers the new Navy Commissioner for the Leeward Islands based in Antigua, John Moutray, and his much younger wife Mary. Antigua was strategically important as the northeasternmost island in the Caribbean. It was a rich possession for the British, its wealth coming from sugar grown on highly developed estates, totally dependent on slavery. Compared with Minorca, another vital island possession, the island was easy to defend. Reefs confined shipping and any hostile landing parties to St. John's in the northwest, an English harbour and Falmouth in the south. Of these, English Harbour was the most important. It had been first used by the Navy in the 17th century. It had a narrow entrance, easily defended with small forts on either side, and the inner harbour could not be seen from the sea. Although not deep like Port Mahon, it made a perfect careening station and was virtually hurricane-proof as an anchorage. By 1725, land at what is now called Nelson's Dockyard, still the only working Georgian dockyard left in the world, had been bought by the Navy to establish a dockyard there. In 1784, Nelson came out to join Collingwood in Boreas, a 28-gun frigate. Together with Collingwood's younger brother Wilfrid, in the sloop Rattler, they set about enforcing the Navigation Acts in the islands, an activity that won them no friends and a number of formidable enemies. The Acts, dating back to the days of Oliver Cromwell, stated that British colonies could only trade with the mother country or other colonies. Since America was no longer a colony, the islands that continued to trade with her did so illegally. That was the view of Nelson and the two Collingwoods. The governors and merchants of the West Indies, who profited from this trade, naturally enough disagreed. Quite who it was that initiated the crackdown on this smuggling is a matter of dispute between historians. After the end of the hurricane season of 1784, Collingwood, by his own statement, or Nelson, by his, prevented an American vessel from entering St. John's. Under a well-known ruse, merchant captains would request permission to dock for repairs. Collingwood offered the services of his carpenter to effect the alleged repairs, and promptly impounded the cargo, while the American master went ashore to complain to the governor, Thomas Shirley, who, like Admiral Hughes, the station's senior officer, seems to have more or less connived in the illicit trade. Once again, Collingwood and Nelson were in their element, defending their country's interests with zeal and in the face of an injustice. While there was little chance of glory or serious action, they knew they were doing their duty, and their friendship became firmer than ever. They drew each other's portraits and developed a mutual admiration. They also developed a strong admiration for Mary Moutray. She and her husband lived in a house on Windsor Hill overlooking the dockyard. All that's left of the house now are a few stone foundations and scatters of broken china, bottles, and whelk shells. Whenever Nelson and Collingwood were at English Harbour, either during the hurricane months or when their ship's hulls were being scraped clean at the careening station, they were invited to dine with the Moutrays. John Moutray was elderly and sick, as Collingwood told his sister, "Commissioner Moutray has but ill health. I am afraid we shall lose them. They are very desirous to get home, and if he is not recalled, I think he will resign. I shall miss them grievously. She is quite a delight, and makes many an hour cheerful that without her would be dead weight." Nelson had even warmer things to say about his dear, sweet friend, who was very, very good to me, and evidently the relationship of the three became intimate. They would frizz her hair for her before a ball, and she would tease them, though there's no suggestion of any impropriety. But they both remained close friends with her in later years. Collingwood, tall and handsome and healthy, compared with Nelson, who was slight and carried a permanent sickly hue from his many fevers, was still writing to her what can only be described as romantic letters. For her part, Mary Moutray was able to coax Collingwood out of the reserve so natural to a man used to his own company in the loneliness of a great ship's cabin. She wrote, "There was a degree of reserve in his manner which prevented the playfulness of his imagination and his powers of adding charm to private society being duly appreciated. But the intimacy of a long voyage gave us the good fortune to know him as he was, so that, after our arrival in Antigua, he was as a beloved brother in our house." Collingwood, returning to England in 1786, was now to spend the longest period of his life at home in Northumberland, without a ship or even the remote prospect of one, but happy in the bosom of his family and able to walk again through the hills, woods and pastures of his beloved Northumberland. Collingwood's brother Wilfrid was dead. In May 1787, Cuthbert received a very touching, typically affectionate letter from Nelson, with the news that Wilfrid, worn out and perhaps carrying some disease, had died while on his way from English Harbour to Grenada in April. Collingwood's reaction to this awful news is not known. From 1786 to 1790, just one of his letters survives. He was now at home with his family, and his correspondence dried up, though there must have been letters to the Admiralty asking vainly for a ship. Collingwood made the best of these years on half pay. He got to know relations he'd barely seen since he was a midshipman, his brother John, his sisters, and the large network of Collingwoods and collateral relations that were scattered across the northeast, from Churton and Gateshead in the south to Morpeth and Musselburgh near Edinburgh. While he'd been away, Newcastle, and indeed the whole country, was experiencing social and industrial change on a grand scale. There was now a Royal Mail coach running between London and Newcastle. Dean Street was in the process of being made by the removal of the old arch of the Low Bridge. The first mechanical threshers, just invented by the brilliant Scottish millwright Andrew Meikle, were about to whir into action on farms across the region, altering forever a pattern of secure but soul-destroying rural labour. Fortunately, the lack of alternative employment in the south that would lead to rick burning and riots was contrasted in the northeast by increased employment to be found in mining, shipping, and other industrial and agricultural developments. Newcastle's heyday would not come for another 20 years. George Stephenson was born in 1781, John Buddle in 1773, William Headley in 1779. But Northumberland's farmers had been innovating for a generation, and fat cattle and Teeswater sheep were already being bred to the amazement of the world. Elsewhere, brilliant industrialists and innovators like Wedgwood, Priestley, Bolton and Watt were introducing new ideas in production, transport and society, everywhere the march of progress, for good or ill. On the one hand were the beginnings of mass unemployment, riots and peasants turned off their land by enclosure acts. On the other, the stirrings of liberalism, Tom Paine, Adam Smith and the Society for the Suppression of the Slave Trade. Collingwood was fascinated by all of this, and his later career shows him to have been innovative and progressive in managing men, but his basic political instincts were cast-iron Tory. The deeply dependable uncertainties of the sea must have made Collingwood and all the other half-pay captains look wistfully to the continent for another war. They would have to wait for 5 years. But if Collingwood could do little to advance his own career, England's future was never far from his mind. He famously, when walking among the hills and fields of Northumberland, filled his pockets with acorns to plant in hedgerows and patches of waste land, so that the navy would never again want for oak trees to build her ships with. She would need them. Social upheaval in France, long seen in England as a domestic matter, now exploded in a revolution that England could not ignore for very long. There was hostility, too, from across the Atlantic. John Paul Jones, expatriate American naval hero come pirate, was harrying the northeast coast, on one occasion firing a cannonball at the church in Alemouth. It missed, bounced 3 times across a field, and landed finally on the roof of a farmhouse. But at the same time it looked as though there would be war with Spain over trading and whaling rights off the northwest coast of America. Collingwood went to London and took rooms in Dean Street at the heart of Soho, from where he made applications to the Admiralty for a ship, using all the influence that his experience and reputation could muster. He must already have made an impression, because he was indeed offered a ship, while Nelson, back home in Norfolk with his new wife, was not. In 1790, Collingwood was given Mermaid, a 28-gun frigate. He spent the winter of 1790 to 91 in the West Indies on a cruise, a pleasant commission which gave an enterprising captain a rather free rein, while the war of the so-called Spanish armament fizzled to nothing. It was the last carefree period in a life which, very soon, would be dedicated to one single ambition, defeat of the French. It also gave Collingwood a chance to get to know his new companion, Bounce. "My dog is a charming creature," he wrote. "Everybody admires him, but he has grown as tall as the table I'm writing on, almost." We do not know what sort of dog Bounce was, though he nearly had his picture taken many years later in Cadiz. But over the years, Collingwood's letters to his family and glowing endorsements from Collingwood's men give us an idea of what he was like. Large and strong, certainly, for Bounce was famous for swimming behind Collingwood's boat when his master was being rowed ashore. He slept next to Collingwood's cot, and, captain or admiral, Collingwood would sing him to sleep with songs that he composed himself. Bounce was the perfect naval dog. Collingwood thought him more intelligent and enterprising than some of his officers, except for one thing. He hated the sound of gunfire. Now, this was a distinct advantage in a dog whose master was dedicated to achieving perfection in the art of naval gunnery. Bounce had to learn to hide among the decks below the waterline whenever he heard the sound of the marine's drum beating the ship to quarters. It was obviously the time in Collingwood's life for making long-term commitments. He was now 42, for he also married. His bride was Sarah Blackett, daughter of the Mayor of Newcastle, and well connected with other Northumberland families such as the Rodhams. They were married in 1791 at St. Nicholas's Cathedral in Newcastle, and went to live in a rented house on Aldgate in Morpeth, close by the banks of the River Wansbeck. This house they later bought, and it remains to be seen today, a sober but respectable squarish townhouse of red brick. Within 2 years they had daughters, Sarah, little Sal, and Mary Patience, on whom Collingwood doted. In a short time his duty would take him to sea again, and he would miss most of their childhood, but they remained his greatest solace in the troubles to come.